The last lecture for this course is today. The review will be at 2 to 3 in room HSW 301 this Thursday, December 1st. I'll post it on CLE. You have one more quiz, online quiz, this weekend. We're going to do the skin, but I'm going to be very specific about neoplasias. And the rest of it is for your reference. In terms of what's also scheduled for the course is anemias. We're not going to get to it, but I'll post a podcast from last year that you can listen to as well as you have the syllabus chapter. I suggest it won't be asked on the exam, but I suggest you listen to it because anemia or decreased red blood cell mass is a form of hypoxia. And you can understand why if you have somebody who has anemia and you're trying to do some type of physical therapy activity, it's going to be a bit of a problem, wouldn't it? So it's important that you listen to it and take it for reference. Okay, but that will not be on the exam. What I'm going to cover in the skin is primarily neoplasias and look about how do we approach the skin and doing skin checks. Because as physical therapists, you're going to be seeing a lot of skin, aren't you? And so it becomes important to recognize certain characteristic lesions or pathology and understand them. And so that's what we're going to cover, and that will be covered on the exam. Okay? The exam will be 1 week from today. 1 week. And it's from 9 to 12. And dictionaries are permitted. Physical dictionaries, not electronic, like we did last time. Does anybody have any questions? Let the skin begin. So what are the five main functions of the skin? What is it? It is a barrier for preventing infections. That's one. Four more. Thermal regulation, very critical. That's two. Three more. Come on, you use your skin. You know your skin well. What do you use it for? Well, that's for because they have a lot of surface area, as far as we're in the body. But just three other that's very dependent upon the skin is, especially for physical therapy, it's a what type of device? It's a mechanical device. It has to stretch, doesn't it? Doesn't it have to, when you bend your elbow, bend your leg, range of motion, that skin has to have elastic recoil and flexibility. So it's a mechanical organ that's very critical. What's the other two functions? It's a barrier for evaporation. If you have this largest organ in the body and you have a large surface area, how much water do you think you lose from your skin if you don't exercise in 24 hours? Do you have any idea? Just by simple evaporation, sitting in a classroom all day or sleeping, it's about 700 mLs of water evaporates from your skin normally. You're breathing, you lose essentially 300 mLs, just simply breathing as a human being without exercising. So these are called insensible losses. So it becomes important to realize it's a barrier not only to infections, but it's a barrier for evaporation. It's another function, a very critical one. It's a sensory organ. It's highly sensory. It's got a huge neuronal component to it. Because how do you know you don't put your finger in a fire and take it out? If you didn't have sensory, you'd burn it. Diabetics lose sensory. They step on a tack, they can't feel a thing. They keep walking. You step on a tack, you'll be up on the ceiling, screaming. So it becomes critical as a sensory organ in terms of touch, feel, pressure, thermal. That becomes very important. Any other functions? So what do we cover? Cover a barrier, thermal regulation, sensory, mechanical. Any other important functions? Those are the important ones, okay? So this becomes important to understand the skin, because as physical therapists, you're going to see it, you're going to touch it, you're going to see how it's going to respond, and it changes. So when we talk about the skin, we have to talk about the histology, and we're going to look at various conditions. So when you think of the skin, we think of the epidermis, which is essentially this layer right here, where we have stem cells in the stratum basal layer. That's where your stem cells are. The stem cells are also down in your hair follicles. And then we have the various layers of the epidermis, where the squamous cells migrate, the spongiform layer, stratum luceum, and corneum. Now the epidermis, one of the layers of the epidermis that becomes thickened is the stratum corneum. What two places in the body has the thickest stratum corneum, the outmost outer layer? Your palms and soles. And that becomes very important, because if it wasn't as thick as it is, how would it deal with trauma, pressure, the forces that are exerted when you use your hands? If the epidermis was thin, it would break down and crack all the time. It would be a poor barrier. Basically, this is where it becomes a critical mechanical feature to prevent damage to it. Then we have the dermis, which is collagen type 1 that we find here. And then in the dermis, we have adnexal structures. We have eccrine sweat glands that are important for thermal regulation that go directly up to the surface. Then we have another type of sweat gland, which is a Holocrine gland, where all the cells of the sebaceous glands contribute, and that's what goes up the hair shaft and makes your hair oily in the morning if you haven't taken a shower or a bath the night before, or you wait until the next day. That's why it becomes oily as a function of time. And what lives in that hair shaft are bacteria. So when next time you take a bath and you're scrubbing or taking a shower, you don't realize it, but the bacteria, when you're rubbing, you're going to bring the bacteria up to the surface. If you took an auger plate, a blood auger plate, before and after, say your arm, you put it in before you took a shower or bath, and then you did the same area, you would have more bacterial colonies after your bath. You may smell nice, but you're just covered with bacteria crawling on the surface of your skin, and you don't even know it. So everyone has bacteria all over their skin. And it's that barrier that's protecting it, and it lives in a symbiotic relationship. What's the condition that traps the bacteria that leads to a problem? Is zits. How many people in this room never had a zit? No one? Oh, really? You're the only one that didn't have a zit up there, huh? Everyone. And what age do you get the zits? What age do you have the most common time to have zits? Teenagers. Why? What causes a zit? Hormones. Everybody throws the hormone card out there and thinks it like spitwad. Nope. Does it matter what you eat, like chocolate or your diet? No. So what's happening in your puberty? Are you going as teenagers? You're having a lot of cell growth, aren't you? So if you look very carefully at this diagram, the answer lies here. If you have bacteria and you have this constant flow of sebaceum going along your hair follicle, this is part of the innate system to clean the heart, keep the heart, hair follicle not trapping bacteria. During puberty, what happens is you have an increased number of stem cells and they're proliferating. So the space becomes narrowed and blocked off. And so what gets trapped in the hair follicle? That bacteria. Now the bacteria sit there and they start to grow. You start to get acute inflammatory cells come in, and now you have a zit. Now, can you get a zit afterwards, after puberty? Where's a common place to get zits? After puberty. After puberty, your age. No. Your butt. Because everyone in this room has got hair on their butt. If you took a magnifying glass, I don't care what sex you are, you could find plenty of hair. So by sitting on your butt, you compress and you don't allow that sebaceum. You can trap bacteria, and that's how people get zits on their butt, because they're sitting too much. So that's why lectures are 50 minutes, so you prevent deep leg vein thrombosis and zits on your butt as a consequence. So you don't realize if you have tight apparel clothing, very tight, that could also lead to obstruction and lead to zits too. So if you want to relive zits, just add some compressive dressing or sit on your butt all the time and you've got issues. So that's an important thing to understand. So here we can see the dermis is collagen, and the dermis varies from site to site, just like the epidermis. Which part of the body has the thickest skin, excluding your palms and soles? What part of your body has the thickest skin on your body? The ventral or the dorsal surfaces? Right, because as animals, that's correct, because think of it. If we're a four, when we're an animal that looks like this and we're crawling, what's facing not the sun and the environment is the ventral surface. So that's why your flexor surfaces are very thin compared to your surface on the extensor surfaces or the dorsum. So your back is much thicker in terms of dermis than your anterior chest wall. Your eyelids has skin, and they are going to have very thin dermis because the function of the eyelid wouldn't be able to open and close the eyes if it was thick like your back. The dermis on your ears is very thin. That's why if you feel your ears, you notice the skin is very thin. So it doesn't take much if you have injury to these areas that you have thin skin that can cause damage and cause site of infection. Here we see Meissner's corpuscles for touch, and you have pressure, sensory. Remember the blood vessels? This organ is rich in blood vessels. We talked about ecchymoses. Remember petechial hemorrhages and hemostasis? And this is where we look for it in the skin. We have erector pinine muscle that where you get the goosebumps as a reflection of stimulation by the nervous system. Cats and animals like that, or other type of animals, they use that for insulation. Because if you bring the hair up and erect it, you increase the dead air space, and that provides insulation when you have that much fur. On us, we don't have enough fur or hair, I should say, and that basically doesn't help us in terms of thermoregulation. And then what's right below is subcutaneous fat, the pannus. Okay? So that's the cell. That's what the skin looks like. Here, histologically, you can see here's the epidermis. Here's the dermis with the collagen type 1. Here are hair follicles. Here's sebaceous glands. These glands right here are eccrine sweat glands. And you can see the base of the hair follicles are here in the subcutaneous fat, depending upon how thick the dermis is. Okay? So, what did people do for centuries? Is look at what organ all the time in any culture, any society, has been the skin. So of all the organ systems, which has the richest vocabulary, the medical dictionary is the skin. No organ system has the amount of descriptive terms that are used. So dermatology, when you describe things, are rich in terms, describing it animals, the surface of animals, or objects, or all sorts of things. And it's very descriptive as a consequence. So when we think about it, these are in your syllabus, it talks about how you want to describe a skin alteration or lesion. One of the things you want to look at is what's called, you run your skin over a lesion, you want to know if it's flat. If it's flat and it's less than 1 centimeter, it's called a macule. If it's greater than 1 centimeter, then it's called a patch. So 1 centimeter is how you wanted to, is the cutoff for various conditions. This is an example of it. We see this red border of a lesion. Here is when it's raised. When it's raised, when you run your finger over it, we call it a papule. If the raised area is less than 1 centimeter, we call it a papule. If it's raised and greater than 1 centimeter, we call it a plaque. Because plaques are raised. And you can see this is a dermatitis. You can see it's raised. And so this is what is described as a papule. We can actually feel it. Here, when it's filled with fluid and it's less than 1 centimeter, we call it a vesicle. If it's greater than 1 centimeter, we call it A blister or bullous is the term that you would describe it. How many people have had a blister? Say you're experts at this. And what causes the blistering is a separation of the epidermis. It can be all the way down to the basal layer that's attached to the basement membrane and separation, or through the spongiform layer right above it. So that's where the blister, the fluid, accumulates. And here's an example of a bullae. Here it's greater than 1 centimeter and it's fluid filled. Should you pop a blister or keep it intact? Well, yeah, it sounds like 50% says keep it intact. Otherwise, it's bothering me. I got to pop it. It's going to be fun doing it. Now, one of the functions of the skin is what? Is a barrier. If you pop it, what happens to that barrier? Now you can get, if you get it soiled material in there or a type of bacteria, you could get an infection. The other thing is, why do you have that fluid? It's rich in growth factors, and it's going to help regeneration to reestablish that epithelium. So by popping it too soon, like taking a scab off too soon, you can delay regeneration. So it's rich in nutrients, and it's important to keep it intact. If you don't pop a blister, what usually happens? It just peels right off. You notice that? Why does it peel off like a scab? It falls off, or you've already reestablished it. It's breaking apart because it's degenerated, and now you have a regenerated epithelium underneath of it. It may be thinner, but it'll eventually become thickened as a function of time. So the moral of the story is, don't pop the blister. It's better. Then this is a pustule. A pustule means it's a vesicle filled with pus. What's a classic viral infection that does this is chickenpox. A herpes virus gives you pustules that are filled with pus. And this is infective. It can be infective. You can see it's red and it's raised. This is called a wheal or urticaria. If you take a dull instrument, like the back of a reflex hammer, and you go along the skin, you can do it on anywhere, your forearms, and you get it swollen and it leaves this welt and it's raised and it's the release of histamine and vasodilators from the mast cells around blood vessels as a consequence. And this can be due to mechanical, or we talk about a hypersensory reaction type 1. This is a scale. When it looks like cornflakes or it's kind of peeling off and it's kind of whitish, scale, that's what you use the word scale. It's the cornified layer peeling off because of some type of increased keratinization on the surface, and we call that a scale. That's the scaliness. What's a common cause for this is when your skin starts to peel after sunburn, you notice it's kind of scaly as you peel it off. People like to pull off the skin as a consequence of this. Another important term is an eschar, which is another name for a scab. And this happens to be on the heel of a person. And this could be where a blister forms, or it breaks down and gets infected, or it's filled with blood as a consequence. Okay. This is an ulcer. Ulcers occur on parts of the body, and the ulcer in this case is a hole, where you've gone through the basement membrane into the dermis, and then all the way, you can see it's kind of yellow, it's going down to the subcutaneous fat. What's a group of people that are well known to have non-healing ulcers of the lower extremity? Are diabetics. They're poor wound healers. They have decreased innervation, sensory neuropathy, and this becomes a problem, and that's why there's a lot of issues with the lower extremity of the feet, and that's why they're a constant companion to podiatrists who have to treat the diabetic foot to prevent gangrenous outcome. So how do we make the diagnosis of a skin disease? One of the things that's important, you have to interview the patient. Has anybody ever had a complete skin check? How long did it take to do the exam from head to toe? 15, 20 minutes. That's probably the most extensive exam someone who's ever going to look at your skin. And they look everywhere. They look behind your ears. They look your border of your neck, where your hair is. They're going to look on your back, your armpits, your groin area, the bottom of your feet, between your toes, your hands. That's a complete skin check. So how many people have, only one or two, everyone in this room should get a complete skin check. And you can, if you have one of your classmates or you don't want, they can look. They'll be able to describe what you find. Because there are places you can't see the back of your arms, for example, or your buttocks and the crack between, all these things. You get a complete skin check if you go to a dermatologist because they're going to go from head to toe. You want to interview the patient, how long they've had the lesion, when is it, what does it occur, what's their occupation, what sort of things do they put on their skin. It could be from makeup to cologne to deodorant, laundry detergent, lotions, you name it, tattoos, everything. So then you examine the rash or growth that you're trying to look at. We're going to confine our discussion to growths. Then you can do a scrape it, you can biopsy it or excise it to see under the microscope what is the pathology, what layers of the skin are involved. And here's what is called a punch biopsy. You can see it's done on the shoulder. You get a local anesthetic of lidocaine, for example, and you do a punch and you get a core, and it looks like this on cross-section. If you ever, anybody ever had a skin biopsy? Did you get a core? Did they shave it or scrape it? Punch, just like this. And that's what they look at. And so what do you see at the layer? Is the epidermis above, and then you see the dermis below. But if you look carefully, you'll notice that there are all these little blue cells. This is a rash, not a neoplasia, but we have inflammation at the interface between the epidermis and dermis, and then we have inflammation around blood vessels, perivascular. So this patient has a rash as a consequence to this. So what are all the different types of conditions that can occur in your skin? There are people that are born without sweat glands. That'd be a real problem, wouldn't it? Especially if they're eccrine sweat glands, thermal regulation. If you didn't have sebaceous glands, that oiliness keeps your skin moist. It can dry out and you get what is called xerosis, or a lot of scaly skin as a consequence. People can be born without nerve endings. That could be a real problem, couldn't it? Because it could be like having congenital diabetes in terms of the outcome. So this becomes important. Rashes, we talk about inflammation. There are hundreds of rashes, or dermatitis they're called. Anybody ever had poison oak or poison ivy? When I was a child, 8 years old, I rolled in poison oak. I didn't know it was poison oak, and I was so red. I was a flaming thrower. And I was itchy everywhere. Because you're releasing vasodilators, it's basically a contact dermatitis that one gets. And so we think of these rashes. Infections, you think of strep or streptococcal infections are common. Hyperplasias, but we're going to look at neoplasias because that's very important. So when we look at this, we're going to look at growths. So the question is, like we've seen before in the principles of neoplasia, is it benign or malignant? And we have to think of all those cells that make up the skin and where the tumors tend to occur. What is the cell lineage? Is it from the squamous cells? You have to worry about if it's a papilloma benign tumor or if it's squamous cell carcinoma. Is it a melanoma arising from the melanocytes in the basal layer? Is it a tumor arising in the fibroblasts in the dermis, giving you what is called a dermatofibroma? Or is it a dermatofibrosarcoma, a malignant countertop? Or lipomas, subcutaneous fat tumor? So it becomes important to know what the cell of lineage is and what is it, benign or malignant? Is it surface epithelium, adnexal epithelium, like the sweat glands, follicles? Are there tumors that arise from the follicles in sweat glands? Yes, but they're not as common as the ones we're going to talk about, basal cell, squamous cell, and melanoma. Is it melanocytic? Because that's what you're really concerned about, because melanocytes, since they derive from the neural crest cells area, they migrate. So now they've become malignant, they have that migratory behavior to begin with, And that's why of all the skin cancers, which one is likely to metastasize to distant sites is malignant melanoma. And so we'll look at that. Is it non-epithelial? As I pointed out, could it be your nerves, your fibroblasts, the muscle, smooth muscle cells, blood vessels, there's hemangiomas, fat, lipomas. Let's start with the keratinocytes. They're what we call keratoses. This is one that you're going to see at what age? At 50. This is the barnacles of old age. And they tend to be on the head and neck and trunk. They don't tend to be in the lower extremities. And they are acquired during life at the age of 50. And keratosis is a condition of increased squamous epithelium. Squamous cells, keratinocytes are synonymous terms. And they're kind of oily. That's where the sebaceous or seborrheic. Then we have warts. How many people have had a wart? All right, wart. And you think of viruses like HPV can lead. There are other viruses as well. They can lead to verrucous or warty-like irregular appearance. And it's basically the infected cells proliferating because of the viral infection. Then another one is what is called solar keratosis. These are scaly lesions that are found in sun-exposed areas. We'll look at this. And this is a precursor for squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. And so these will be easy to look at, and we'll take a look at these in a moment. And actinic means sun rays. That's why it's called actinic, or AK lesions is the acronym that people use. So seborrheic keratosis is a scaly, so it's kind of increased keratinization on the surface. It's a benign growth. It usually occurs after the age of 50 as a sign of aging. They resemble kind of irregular surface like a wart, but they do not contain any virus like HPV. And because it's on the head and neck, you're more worried about what? Its cosmetic appearance. And because there's proliferation of melanocytes, it can simulate that of malignant melanoma. We're going to compare and contrast the two. And it's not precancerous. So this is what it looks like. Here's the example. These are rays. They tend to be papules. They can be greater than 1 centimeter. It can be like a plaque. And you can see there can be a lot of these. So this is where you want to look at someone's back. And you ask the question, how long have you had it? Well, I just started getting it when I was middle-aged. So that tells you these are not congenital. And so it tends to occur as a function of aging. Here is a woman. And you can see that her back is full of seborrheic keratoses. Hundreds of these. So it becomes now an issue of cosmetic. We went the wrong way. There's one example. Here, or it could be raised in this case, and it's well circumscribed. You can see it has a very distinct border at its edge. It's raised because of the proliferation of keratinocytes, but we also see pigmentation. So there's a hyperplasia of melanocytes in the basal layer of this lesion. And these, how are these removed? They're basically like the barnacle on the side of a ship. You just scrape it off. You actually do what is called a shave biopsy, like you're planing wood, and it comes right up. I'll show you what it looks like in a moment. Here's another one. It's kind of scaly. You see the whitest scaly appearance. And then it's well circumscribed. It's kind of pigmented, but it has a sharp border. And it can occur whether it's in sun-exposed or sun-exposed areas, like the So it just depends. So when you look at this, you notice at the base of this lesion, it's flat. The proliferation stops. Because if it was malignant, it would be showing what? Invasion into the dermis. So this tells me, just at low magnification, that this is benign. Proliferation, we see this thickened epidermis, proliferation of squamous cells or keratinocytes. And then we see the scaly part is this keratinization on the surface. These are, you can form these cyst-like cavities filled with this keratinized material. And here we can see there's small nuclei, and you see it's basically placed it's not showing up here. I used my arrow. Sorry about that. So right here at the basal layer, you see it's well uniform, and there's some pigmented cells, melanocytes, and then you can see this what was called a cyst, this cavity filled with keratinized material. So solar keratosis is sun-exposed areas. And this is where it becomes very important. So if you're balding as a male, you should always wear a hat because you see them on their scalp is a common place. And I'll show you an example in a minute. Another place is the dorsum of the hands, because what is exposed to the sun all the time? Not your palms, but your dorsum. Your tip of your ears is a very common place where you see these lesions, or the back of the ear, because people are doing what? Gardening, playing golf, doing something that they're putting their head down, or the back of their neck. And so depending upon what they're wearing, and you'll see these lesions. So basically, they're a papule or plaque, so it's either less than 1 centimeter raised or greater than 1 centimeter. They're kind of scaly. They're going to be sun-exposed areas to UV radiation. They're a precursor for squamous cell carcinoma of the skin, which is the second most common skin cancer. And this is what it looks like. What's the age of this patient just looking at their hand? Does your hand look like that? No. What do you notice? Does this patient have a lot of wrinkles? Yes. Is the skin thick or thin? Thin. And that's why this is from an older person. And you see those white scaly lesions? These right here, you can see, this is the actinic keratoses. People like to pick at these, and they bleed, but they're not a scab, but these are proliferation of squamous cells, and out of that, mutations can occur and then give rise to squamous cell carcinoma. Does he have a few? I would say so. So that whole hand has been damaged over decades of exposure to sun, and so his risk for developing squamous cell carcinoma is guaranteed as a matter of time. So this is a person that's going to be a constant visiting the dermatologist to make sure these lesions will become invasive squamous cell carcinoma. Has anybody ever seen these type of lesions on the hand like this? So when you look at your patients, look at their hands, especially if they're construction workers, people that work outside. Here you see in the back of the ear. So this is a very important to look at because people bending over all the time. Here's a gentleman that doesn't wear a hat and or sunscreen, and you can see he's got liver spots. Do you know what liver spots? How many people know what those are? And who gets them? So you don't have to worry, because you would be, if you got them at this age, you'd be talking about it. So the liver spots are basically macules that are stimulated by sun exposure. And who gets them? Older people. No matter what sex. So if you want to get liver spots, the more time you sit in the sun, over a period of time in your life, you start getting liver spots on those sun-exposed areas. So these brown areas that you see here are liver spots. But then you see these keratinized areas up here. Here's kind of a whitish area. He's got to worry about squamous cell carcinoma of the scalp as a consequence. Here you can see it at the border of the hairline, where you want to look very carefully, where you can see that there's a scaliness, a reddish area, and so that's what it can look like. This is what it looks like microscopically. Here you see the keratinization on the top here. It almost looks like a plume going straight up. And then you see this proliferation of squamous cells here and here, and that's where the mutations are going to take place and give rise to squamous cell carcinoma. If you look at the base of this, you can see that it's flat, so there's no invasion. This is what is called the granular layer. You see it's still here as well. So it's not quite there yet to become a malignant squamous cell carcinoma. If you go to higher magnification, you can see there's an inflammatory response occurring, and you see these more dysplastic-looking cells where they've lost their size and shape compared to the normal squamous cells that are going through hyperplasia on this side. So these are becoming morphologically abnormal. And then out of that will arise the squamous cell carcinoma. Here you see at higher magnification, you can see a prominent nucleolus, and you can see there's dysplastic change, high NC ratio, all these things that showing you that these are going to go on to become malignant. And here is a melanocyte. You see the brown pigment in the cytoplasm in this lesion. So when we talk about malignant epithelial neoplasms, the most common one, the most common human cancer of the skin is basal cell. And it rarely metastasizes, but it can be locally invasive, like squamous cell. How many cases? It's over 1 million now of basal cell carcinoma in the United States each year. How young can you see it? You can see people who have been in the sun as children, as teenagers, 20s, and you can see basal cell in people getting it in their 30s. So the rest of their life, they're always going to have skin checks because their propensity of developing cancer in the skin is quite high. The second most common one is squamous cell carcinoma, also associated with UV radiation, and it's relatively common, and it's less number of cases. Now it's up to 300,000 cases a year. So of all the cancers that occur in the human body, what's the most common? Skin cancer, because every time you go out in the sun, you're getting UV damage as a consequence. So moderation is very important. This is what a basal cell carcinoma looks like. You can see at the hairline, it starts to become cavitary. It becomes necrotic. You can see angiogenesis. You see blood vessels coming into the viable part of the tumor. It has what is called a pearl-like sheen reflection on its surface, as you can see. Here you can see it becoming a little scaly. You see it's peeling off. And then you see it has a nodular appearance to it. And so if you saw a lesion like this, you would tell the patient to do what? What would you tell them? Which doctor would you tell them to go to? Dermatologist, that's right. You're going to be working with patients, and you may see lesions no one else will look has seen before, even the primary care, because most primary care, do they do a complete skin check? They do a primary care check on you. Oh, yeah. So you can be walking with lesions you don't even know about it, so it becomes very important. Okay? Here's another one on the nose. And what do you notice? What do you see those sort of serpiginous structures that are red going toward the tumor? What do you think those are? Blood vessels. So this is a tumor that needs angiogenesis in order to survive. What do you notice happening to the center of the tumor? It's ulcerating. These are called rodent ulcers. And as the tumor becomes necrotic in the center because it doesn't get enough blood supply because it's multiplying, it dies and it gives this ulcerative appearance. It can be also more like a patch and is growing in a very horizontal pattern. It has an irregular border, it's asymmetrical, and it's in a sun-exposed area. I'm showing you that basal cell carcinoma, like any lesions of the skin, they come like, you know, when you go to Baskin Robbins, you're going to get what? Ice cream. But because there's 31 flavors, there's 31 flavors for all these different lesions. And they come in different appearances. And so I'm giving you a spectrum. So it's not you memorize one that's always going to be looking like that, but the variety that one sees. Here's another basal cell. It has an irregular border. It's asymmetrical. It's basically lifting up in more of a papular to a papular or plaque-like lesion. Here it's pigmented. You think at first, you look at this, you worry about malignant melanoma at the edges. And you can see there's some, and they can get proliferation. And you can see it has it's asymmetrical, but it still has a sharp border. When you look at the normal squamous cells, and we look at this first, here's the basal layer. That's where this basal cell carcinoma is arising from, these stem cells that you see down here. Then here's the normal epidermis, but what do we see is this basaloid or basal type of cells that are now what? Invaded into the dermis, showing you this is malignant at low power. If you look over here, you see tongues of tumor invading into the dermis. You see it here as well, because here we have our normal reference. The normal thickness, and you can see the dermis, so this is sun-exposed areas and leading to basal cell carcinoma. Here we see at the edge of the tumor, the nuclei are perpendicular to picket fence along its edge. Here we can see it here. Now let's turn ourselves to squamous cell carcinoma. Now this is, what part of the body are we looking at? The mouth, at the corner of the mouth. And your lips are squamous epithelium. But it doesn't have hair follicles, just like your anus. That's what your anus and lips have in common. They don't have hair. And so you don't have to worry about sebaceous glands. Maybe it has some eccrine sweat glands. But you notice, what's the color of the lesion? What's the color of the lesion? White. When you have squamous cell carcinoma, they're making all that keratin, and it'll give this white lesion. Where do you think is the most common place to get squamous cell carcinoma? The upper lip or lower lip? And then why? The lower lip, because what's facing the sun? Upper lip or lower lip? Lower lip. So don't pout when you're outside. Stick out your lip out there, and it looks like this. Here you see a patient with an ulcerating lesion. Why is it the worst place to get squamous cell or cancer on your lip? Because the oral cavity around it is rich in blood vessels and lymphatics. So if I'm a cancer, we know our lip is very thin. It doesn't take much to get in there and get in lymphatics and disseminate. So it's a bad place. Here you see a large squamous cell carcinoma. Now, what sex is this patient? Now, you know many females will allow their lip look like that, but who would, because I have a Y chromosome, would be in denial and not deal with this? Are males. Classic for any type of lesion. And so you can see that this has been there for a while. So the likelihood of invading and causing destruction is quite high. So when you see lesions like this, you want to intercede when it's early on rather than when it's later. How do I know it's squamous cell carcinoma? Because I can see here the epidermis. Here is the base membrane. And then we see all this invasive squamous cell carcinoma. Here is a keratin pearl showing keratinization of squamous origin. Here we can see, here we can see the keratinization right here in this pinkish area. And this is invasive squamous cell carcinoma. So it's UV light. Do we have tanning booths in San Francisco? Yes. They're around. Just have to look for them. And they tell you that they're safe because they use UVA. But UVA creates what? Wrinkles, and it's still carcinogenic. So if you go to a tanning booth, what are you paying for? Wrinkles and skin cancer. UVB is carcinogenic. Not as much. It's more carcinogenic than UVA. And so this becomes important because you think of B, you think of burns. Versus A for aging. If you want to wrinkle your skin, stay out in the sun longer. It's a very easy way to get wrinkles, the sun, chronic sun exposure. And then there's UVC. So solar damage is an important risk factor for both basal cell and squamous cell carcinoma. And this is a leading cause because of solar damage. And it's a cumulative dose. As you cause damage to your stem cells that are proliferating, the get further mutations. Any questions about basal cell and squamous cell carcinoma? If you don't take care of basal cell carcinoma, it rarely metastasizes, but people have known if they got it on their scalp or their head, it could grow right through your skull into your brain because of the invasive nature of it. It can be highly destructive to the tissues of the head. Benign tumors that are non-epithelial or mesenchymal, we think of a very common tumor. How many people have seen babies with what are called strawberry marks on their hands or face? What that is a congenital hemangioma. They're strawberry because they're vascular channels. What do you do with these lesions? Nothing. They spontaneously regress as a function of time. And they can be small or quite large. Another one is a benign proliferation of fibroblasts in the dermis. These are firm nodules deep in the dermis. And it can often get hyperpigmentation above in the surface. Here's what a hemangioma looks like. You can see it. It's elevated, so this would be like a papule. It's red, well circumscribed, and we can see that this is definitely a baby's arm. And when you look at it microscopically, you see these septa or vascular channels that are filled with blood, and it's a benign tumor. It's the most common benign tumor of vascular cells, here, hemangiomas. Here's what a dermatofibroma looks like. You can see it's pigmented, and it's firm underneath. So this is what it looks like. Here we see this fibroblastic proliferation, this dark pink area, and this increased number of cells. And you can see the reticular dermis, the collagen type 1, these dark refractile bundles being pulled in as this proliferating lesion of fibroblast takes place. Let's go to melanoma and nevi. How many people have a mole somewhere in their body? Most of you should raise your hands because if everyone probably has a mole. Are They're either going to be moles or nevi, and they usually can either be acquired. What stimulates mole formation is sun exposure, because you're stimulating the melanocytes. So if you want more moles and you have a propensity to develop moles, go out in the sun. Or it can be congenital. How many people have congenital nevi that you've had since birth? Say, there you go. How many people got them after birth? Those are the acquired. There you go. See? You're meeting the demographics. Now, we have to worry about when they become malignant or malignant melanoma. So the word nevus means birthmark. And it can be acquired due to sun exposure or congenital. They can be deep in the dermis, and they have a blue appearance. They're called blue nevus, especially in a fair-skinned individual, or non-blue. Here's an example looking at someone's back. Now, what tells me this is not keratinitis or seborrheic keratosis? What's the age of this patient? Does this look like a 50-year-old or someone under the age of 50? You've seen enough backs. Young or old? Young. When do you get seborrheic keratosis? After 50. So these are going to be, and you ask the patient, oh, I've had these since birth. These are congenital nevi. And they can be multiple. Here you can see it's oval. You draw a line through the center. It's symmetrical in both short and long axes and uniform in color. They can be congenital, like this one. They can be in the face area, for example. It can be the genitalia. It can be anywhere on the body. And they can get quite, you see this is at the border of the hair, and they can get quite large. And here's a woman that was born with a giant melanocytic nevus. Now you can see she's got every part of the body, but you notice, you see those surgical incisions, you see that checker, what's the problem of having such a large nevus? You can get malignant melanoma arising in it. So this person should not go in the sun. And so these were excisional biopsies of changes to this giant nevus that had to be removed because of malignant melanoma arising in a giant nevus like this. Has anybody ever seen a patient or a person with a giant nevus? Well, you will eventually. Don't worry. They're out there. You don't see them out sun tanning because of obvious reasons. Now, this is dysplastic. When you see a lesion like this, you got to tell the patient to go to the dermatologist because this would be on the way to becoming malignant melanoma. This is definitely asymmetrical, has an irregular border. It has not uniform in color. And they probably got it after birth. Now, when we do a nevus, the melanocytes can be, in this case, dividing in the dermis. We call this raised or papule. That would be a intradermal nevus. If they're proliferating at the junction of the epidermis and dermis, we call this a junctional nevus. So this is flat. So when you have a lesion on the skin, you should always feel it, because it gives you a sense of where is it proliferating. In the dermis? Is it in the junction? Whether it's raised or not raised. So clinical facts. Melanoma is increasing because of early detection, people becoming more aware, plus people are spending time in the sun, because people feel that if you're darkly skinned, that means you're healthier than others. Is there any correlation between the color of your skin and your health? None. So you should be happy with what your pigmentation is. And so, obviously, light-skinned individuals have an increased risk. If you're darkly pigmenting, can you avoid skin cancer completely? The answer is no. So even if you're darkly pigmented, you can still get skin cancer. May take a little longer, but you can still get it. And so if you have a lot of nevi, 300-400 nevi throughout your body, the number of cells that are dividing can get mutation, increase the risk. UV exposure is very important as a risk factor. Here you can see a superficial spreading when it's horizontal. Growth, you can see this is on the cheek of a male. Here you see another one that's more horizontal growth. Which is the one that's when it becomes nodular and starts to invade deep the vertical growth, because it can get down to the dermis where there are lymphatics and spread and metastasize. Here you see is another malignant melanoma. This is very worrisome. It's raised, it's scaly on the surface. Here's one with both horizontal growth along the epidermis, and here is going to be more vertical growth as it's raised. The likelihood of going down into the dermis increases. Here's one on your palm, at the base of your palm, at wrist, and here is a superficial spreading melanoma. Can you get melanoma in the oral cavity? Yes, because melanocytes go, or neural crest cells go to the oral cavity to form various structures. And so you can get malignant melanoma in the oral cavity. Here you see the melanocytes going to the surface, invading these clear space cells and these nests of melanocytes in the dermis. So prognosis, if you catch it early, it's great survival. If it goes to a regional lymph node, it becomes increased risk of poor prognosis. And if it's widely metastatic, it's a problem, obviously. So it's thickness. Vertical growth is important. And then what sex does better, females versus males? Is it better to get malignant melanoma on your hands and feet or your trunk? It's better on your hands and feet because it has a longer distance to travel compared to be on your torso, where it can spread at a shorter distance. So treatment is complete excision, re-excision if necessary, sentinel biopsy lymph nodes in the upper extremity. The first lymph node is right here in your trochanter, in the medial part of your upper extremity, or the popliteal fossa. And then nodal dissection, chemotherapy, biological response, modifiers, and all sorts of, or immunotherapy. We will stop at this point. Any questions about neoplasias of the skin? All right, we will see you on Thursday. Have a great day. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.